welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn and this is special anniversary episode number 200 of the podcast, and it is the 29th of October 2014 as I record this. So yeah, very exciting. Break out the champagne and everything. Episode 200 seems absolutely crazy. When you start these things, you never expect them to kind of go on to this point. So I'm pretty excited to be talking about this stuff today. The first show went out in March 2009, so I've been doing this for over 4.5 years, every couple of weeks. So yeah, it's a good milestone. So I'm basically doing an extended introduction today, well, like half the show, talking about the last 100 episodes, because episode 100 I actually did a roundup. So this is a kind, and that episode 100 was July 2011. So I'm reflecting on the time between 100 and 200, basically. I'm going to talk about that. And then I've got an interview, which is kind of more of a conversation, with my friend Alexis Grant, whose blog you might know. Well, she has alexisgrant.com, but also thewritelife.com. And I met Lexi online on Twitter when we both first started out. And we, our kind of trajectories have been similar. We both left our day jobs within a couple of months of each other, after sort of working part-time on our stuff for 3 years, and we both now have, I guess, more mature online businesses. So I wanted to, you know, kind of use the discussion with Lexi as a way to reflect on why we're both still here when so many of the people we started out with kind of disappeared. So I will come back to that interview after we go through the kind of reflection. So just to sort of think about where I was. So when I recorded episode 101, which was with David Wood about writing action adventure thrillers, David writes the Dane Maddox series, which is awesome. And at that point, August 2011, my first novel, Pentecost, had come out that year, and at that point I'd sold 7,500 copies, and I also at that point had my original batch of 3 non-fiction books, none of which are available anymore, because, you know, fiction doesn't age, but non-fiction sure does. And I retired 2 of those books and rewrote How to Enjoy Your Job, which is now for sale as Career Change, which I rewrote in 2012 after I went full-time author entrepreneur. So really interesting. I also had that, the first book was published under Joanna Penn. So I've put a picture on the blog post, the show notes for this, of me holding the original version. And since then, I actually did a rewrite anyway. Amusingly, I haven't actually written this in the show notes, but it also in this time I got a New York agent and then split up with her. So very happily, it's all on the blog. But it's and I did a rewrite of Pentecost because she wanted to sort of sell it as Arcane. But so interesting when you start thinking about what's happened over the last couple of years. I had just moved back to London. I'd lived in Australia and New Zealand for 11 years. I actually left London in the year 2000. To go traveling and basically just didn't come back for a long time. So it's funny to think that, you know, I'd only just moved back to London when I recorded that episode. I was still in the August 2011, I was still working in my day job as a business consultant implementing accounts payable systems into large corporates, and I was working at a multinational mining company at that point, and it was deathly boring, and I was really miserable, and I was almost at that tipping point of, I have to leave my day job. I just have to. I can't stand it anymore. I was crying, you know. So it's really, it's crazy, really. And great to think about. And this is one of the really good things about blogging. Because you do write things as they happen, over time you actually see the development of how things have changed, which is cool. Also at that point in 2011, the big names in self-publishing were Amanda Hocking, John Locke, and J.K. Rowling had just launched Pottermore, her own company selling ebooks and where fans can, you know, create things in her world, like fan fiction and pictures and stuff. And J.K. Rowling had never sold her ebook rights, and she started Pottermore to sell direct. Essentially the first big name to go indie, although because, you know, obviously the word self-publishing doesn't apply to her, she started a company, but essentially she went independent. She decided not to use a publisher. She started her own company. People always seem to forget the fact that she was really the first big name to go direct to fans, which is, you know, what we all talk about these days. But Amanda Hocking obviously signed a deal. John Locke's still going. He just doesn't blog very much because his kind of 99-cent approach became less popular, and things, you know, came out about how he did some of that stuff. And but you know, he's still going and still writing and still putting books out, so just doing the work and reaching readers, which is great. So 3 years on, I guess, November 3 and a bit years on from that episode 101, I'm a full-time author entrepreneur happily living in London. I have 8 fiction books, novels, novellas, and short stories. I have 5 full-length books now, 2 novellas and a book of short stories. And I have 4 non-fiction books selling in 58 countries, in 4 languages, and in ebook, print, and audiobook formats. And I actually put together what I'm calling sort of my asset register, which you do when you have an official business. You have like, these are a list of my assets, and I'm going to do a blog post on it at some point, but it's essentially just a matrix of all my books and the languages and the formats, and what it enables you to see when you put it into a matrix is what is missing. So for example, I don't have an audiobook of the German edition of Desecration Verletzung. So that's something that I can either sell, or I can use ACX to try and find a German narrator. I don't have an audiobook version of How to Market a Book, and I am going to record that myself and sell that direct. So doing the asset register is great, but I basically, when I totted it all up, I currently have 39 separate products available purely out of the books I have. So that's 12 books of various lengths, which equals 39 separate products, which is very cool when you think about it. And the penny for me dropped around exploiting multiple rights around, I guess, 18 months ago. So within this period, I've really gone from being somebody who had a business model around, you know, internet, you know, sales and professional speaking, primarily to exploiting the rights of my creative work. I am still an international professional speaker, and I've been speaking all over the place over the last couple of years. So that's very cool. Just in the last few months, I've been to Stockholm and Frankfurt, and which is great. And next year I'm going to America. I'll be in Charleston for PubSmart in March. So that will be my first speaking gig in America. And I should hopefully also be back at Thrillerfest in New York. Another kind of highlight, I guess, was in February 2014, this year, my book One Day in Budapest was part of a box set, The Deadly Dozen, that hit the New York Times and USA Today bestseller list. So many people consider that, getting those kind of lists, as a real high point. And it's been interesting for me when I think about what I have achieved. I still have not achieved what I consider my baseline achievement or my baseline goal, which is right now to replace the income that I gave up when I left my day job. But you've got to remember, and I always tell my husband this, I was a software business consultant for 13 years. I've been a full-time author now, author entrepreneur, for 3 years. So if I can get back up to that income within the next couple of years, I'll be doing really well. So it's funny, we all have a different measure of success. I talk about this in a lot of the nonfiction books, but I'm really, you know, it's great to see how things have progressed, but I still feel like I have a long way to go. But by reflecting on this, by episode 300, you know, let's say this now, by episode 300, my goal will certainly to have been replaced my the income that I left behind. Right, so just to reflect on a few of the memorable episodes that impacted my creative life and my business. So I would say that I love every episode. I mean, I learn something every time from the people that I talk to. So the ones that I'm pulling out now, when I look at the backlist at thecreativepen.com/podcasts, it's, and which again is hilarious because when I first started, I used the word podcasts with an S on the end because, you know, I didn't know it was a podcast with one T. You know, these are the things that that happen for us all. But when I, you know, kind of run my eye down 100 episodes on the show, I can, you know, find amazing things in all of them. So I certainly don't want to discredit all of the amazing people I've talked to in the last few years. Very excited to talk to any of these people. But in terms of when I actually thought about how various episodes impacted my life, these are some of the ones that stood out for me. And probably other ones will stand out for you. And I'd love to hear, you know, which ones have stood out for you. And please do leave a comment on the show notes or something. That would be fantastic. So first up, you know, and this is a reasonably recent interview, in June this year, there is one book that I own in all three formats, print, ebook, audiobook, and that's Turning Pro by Stephen Pressfield. I reread it several times a year and it kicks my butt every time. So interviewing Steve about his book, The Lion's Gate, and being able to ask him questions about resistance and turning pro and the muse, pretty much made my podcasting experience all worth it. I mean, this is years of work and many, many hours of, you know, podcasting doesn't pay, basically. You know, you can cover your costs, and I'll come back to that later. But, you know, most people don't make an income from podcasting. It's more done for the love of it. And, you know, I have thought about giving up the podcast, but when I interviewed Steve, I was just like, wow, you know, it's all just been so worth it to build things to a point where someone like him would come on my show. So I was a total fangirl in the interview, but that was like the universe rewarding me, and it was a real high point in my kind of career. I would absolutely love to interview Stephen King. He would probably be the other one, the two Steves in my life, Pressfield and King. If I could interview Stephen King, you know, that again, that would be another real high point. We've all got to have our, you know, mentors. And but also what kind of compounded the experience of interviewing Steve Pressfield was in the same, literally it was kind of the same 10-day period, I interviewed David Morrell, who's most well known for First Blood, which became Rambo, and has been writing for like 40 years, and Bob Mayer, who is a, you know, a huge name in the indie space, and, you know, has over, I think, 60 plus books now. So I mean, getting to interview these kind of three veterans was amazing, and they can teach us all longevity in the game as well as discipline and always learning new things. I mean, that's what's so great about the people that I meet and, you know, the people that I love to talk to, really. They're always learning, always. And, you know, I'm always thrilled to talk to David Morrell because he's so humble. You know, he's been in the game, the writing game professionally for 40 years, and yet he's asking me questions about how I do things. So the lack of ego is incredible. So that those were also kind of standout interviews. And then in terms of what has kind of changed my business development, the interview I did with Orna Ross on rights in July 2013 completed the picture in my head of how rights work. And it's so funny, if the penny hasn't dropped for you yet, I really urge you, listen to that interview, listen to the interviews with Jane Friedman in May 2014 and Elizabeth Hyde Stevens in July this year. And we, in those interviews, I talk about business, a lot more about the business. And the three of those ladies and the books they write and their blogs together kind of resulted in my move into translations, into audiobooks, and also my book Business for Authors, where I essentially try and explain everything that I've learnt about business for authors, hence the title. But if the penny hasn't dropped for you around rights, really, this is something you want to spend a bit of time on. You can also look, Dean Wesley Smith talks about this, and so does Christine Catherine Rush, around, you know, understanding how rights work. It will blow your mind when you realise how it all works. And many authors just haven't, you know, haven't got it yet. But for me, there's, you know, what's the point in interviewing these amazing people unless I take action myself? So I hope you also get actionable information from the show. I hope you have put some of what people say into, you know, into your business. I think it's really important that we continue to learn. And, you know, I hope I can keep providing more help for you. So another thing on the more kind of creative side, one of the big things I've been working through and, you know, still have to work through, I think we all do, is fear of judgment and how to stop self-censoring. Because as if you read my fiction, or, you know, I J.F. Penn is a different character. J.F. Penn is my, what Carl Jung would call my shadow side, the side that is interested in you know, writing crime and writing supernatural stuff and death and, you know, a lot of deep and meaningful stuff that I bring out in my books. But also, I also write kick-ass action adventure and I have fight scenes and lots of things that, you know, many people would be surprised to read of me. And so I talk about this in an interview I did with Chuck Wendig in November 2012. And Chuck has a blog, Terrible Minds, which may or may not be to your taste. It's definitely not safe for work. And he has a very unique voice, but I really enjoyed his book Blackbirds and the follow-up Mockingbirds, and very dark books. So I interviewed Chuck about that, and he really helped me around self-censorship, so that was great. In terms of writers' daily word count and the work ethic, and, you know, how to really be a professional writer whose business is based on writing, I continue to be inspired, as I know many of you are, from by the boys of the self-publishing podcast, Johnny B. Truant, Sean Platt, and David Wright, all of whom I've interviewed separately on the show. So that's actually pretty cool, because when you talk to them separately, they are a lot more serious, I guess, but that's generally the tone I have on my show. But it's great to kind of talk to them about their journey. Johnny Truant, particularly since 2011, my episode 100, when Johnny still only had one book that had taken him, I think, 10 years. He has now just, you know, become a writing machine. So when you see somebody else's transformation, it can really help you with your own. I also want to mention the episode with Kerry Wilkinson in November 2013, who totally floored me with some of his daily word counts. And I remember asking him very clearly, and I don't ever re-listen to my shows, by the way. I So I haven't actually re-listened to these. I've just read the show notes and kind of remembered things. But with Kerry, I remember saying to him, so Kerry, you've signed a 15-book deal with whoever it was, publisher, big publisher. Doesn't that mean you're locked in for the next however long, you know? And he said, I've written all the books already. I was like, oh, right. Okay, fair enough. And if you check out Kerry Wilkinson, you'll see he's written a stack of books. So again, he's like Johnny, Sean and Dave, but he doesn't talk about this very much. He's one of those kind of working writers who just gets on with it and doesn't talk about it, which sometimes I think, you know, is perhaps the best way. But no, I like helping other people and learning new things myself. So I have a different way of doing things. I also wanted to, you know, back on the business stuff, another change has been the kind of the move into audiobooks. And I have a couple of interviews, one with J. Daniel Sawyer on how to record and distribute, which sort of started my interest. And then I actually did a deal with an American small press and started my audiobooks before ACX launched. And I have interviews with my narrators, Veronica Jaguer and Rosalind Ashford, on the podcast as well. And both of they kind of represent another major pillar of my business now, you know, money coming in every month from Audible, which is truly exciting, considering you just need to, you know, get those things done. You don't, it didn't cost me any money because I do 50-50 royalty split. So yeah, very exciting. And then the final thing is really talking strategy with, so you would have just heard that little noise. Have you heard that noise? It's like a little beepy. That's actually my day one. This is a tip I got from Dean Wesley Smith. Just going off piece here for a moment. It's called Day One, and it's just one of these journaling apps that pops up at certain points in the day, and you write down what you're doing at that point. And it's really interesting. It kind of, when you look back, it reminds you of what you were doing every day. It's just another kind of extra accountability thing, because if you look back and what you're doing every day is playing on Twitter or whatever, it's not very good. Anyway, going back to talking strategy. So yes, interview I did with Charlie Gilkey back in, let's see, April this year, was part of the catalyst for making some decisions around my own business model shift. So for example, stopping doing guest posts on the blog and also getting a virtual assistant, outsourcing more things, focusing on sharing my journey rather than, you know, other people's. And, you know, we all need those moments when we examine what the hell we're doing, because otherwise, years later, we take a look around and go, how did I get here? How did I become this? So this is really important. So, for example, I want to not do as much speaking. I had said I would only do one a month, and then it all just went nuts. So, but I can't do more than one a month. Speaking, it totally exhausts me. You know, this introvert is becoming more and more introverted. And I like spending the time in my head making stuff up, and, you know, like talking to you guys now, I'm on my own. It's not this is not taxing energetically, but like Frankfurt, for example, totally finished me off in terms of my energy, and I almost kind of get sick afterwards from energy drain. So I have to be really careful with my managing that in the next year. I love speaking. So if you are coming to watch me live or join one of my live things, then I'm totally loving being there. I'm just saying that it does drain me over time if I do too much. So, not much longer, and then we'll get into the interview. But I wanted to mention that I did consider making this the last show. I thought, yay, 200, fantastic, I will stop. Because podcasting is such a big commitment in terms of time, and I need more hours on my fiction if I'm going to grow that side of things faster and meet my goals there. But when I really reflected on it, the fundamentals of why I do this still stand. I learn something from every person I interview, and it enriches my own creative life, which has got to be a good reason to do stuff. Plus, it hopefully helps you along your journey. And, you know, I often say that I wanted to be like a British Tony Robbins, like somebody who helps other people through what they do. And, you know, that's why I blog, that's why I podcast. I really, really enjoy helping people. It enriches my soul. So I do want to carry on. And also, the, you know, by meeting people and interviewing them, it helps me connect with authors and entrepreneurs all over the world. So, you know, again, introverts can spend a lot of time on their own, and getting on Skype for an hour really helps me, you know, get out there a bit more. So that's good. And I do have, in terms of financial commitment, I have two corporate sponsors who pay for hosting, which is fantastic. And today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life. And I love Kobo. I think, you know, I know many authors, all of us would say, obviously, Amazon is a dominant income stream. But for me, Kobo is my second income stream, which is quite significant. So I've recently just been doing some reports on my earnings and this, that and the other. And Kobo, you know, some months I'm just like, wow, that's amazing. You know, that's fantastic. And we've got to, again, you know, I always say this, think about what I've just shared in terms of how far things, you know, things have changed in the last 3 years. How are things going to change in the next 3 years? And I'm very excited about what Kobo is doing. You know, they have a Japanese CEO now. They're owned by Rakuten, which is a Japanese commerce company. And, you know, we do not know what the next step is going to be for these companies, for the global reach of self-publishing. I think about this in terms of a very big play for the globe. You know, I'm not just thinking about selling books in England. I'm not just thinking about Amazon.com. I'm not just thinking about, you know, next month. If we reflect back to when I chatted with Sean Platt about this, you know, we're talking about 5 years' time, 10 years' time. Hopefully, I'm 40 next year. Let's say another 40 years. You know, what is going to happen in 40 years' time? So why I like Kobo Writing Life, why I'm not exclusive, is because I have a much longer term view, I think, and I believe in building up audiences wherever there are audiences. So big thank you to Kobo Writing Life for supporting the blog for the last over the last year and going forwards. And also I do have another sponsor, 99 Designs, so they're alternating, so I'll obviously talk about them next time. I also have many of you supporting me on Patreon, which is fantastic, giving a few dollars for two episodes a month, which I really appreciate. So even if I do more than two, I only charge, you know, charge for two. Have some people giving a dollar, some people giving $3, some people giving $5 per show. Thank you so much for your support. And a shout out today to new supporters, Melissa Worcester, John Pierce and Adam Hennig. Thank you for your support, guys, and thank you to everybody who's a patron of the show. And you can find a list of the patrons at thecreativepen.com/patrons, and that's all the people who support the show. And if you would like to support my time, because the corporate sponsors pay for the hosting, etc., and my time is kind of extra, if you would like to support my time, it's Patreon, patreon.com/thecreativepen. And that's fantastic. So I'm committing to another year, and I think I've also committed to 300 shows. So that will be a couple of years, most likely. But time flies, you know, time super flies. And if you think that this was, so this 100 episodes has taken kind of 3 years. So we'll see, you know, what happens by episode 300. It's all pretty exciting. Okay, just as a kind of quick normal update on my writing progress, I've, as well as getting to episode 200, I finished the first draft of Gates of Hell, which I'm really pleased with. super climax, if I do say so myself. I just can't, you know, I love these big climactic scenes. I can't help it. They're always a big deal in my books. Love the big climax. I'm excited about that. And my intention was to finish that and then do NaNoWriMo with a completely different series. But I've just decided, because I want to get into the second draft and I want to stay in my arcane world rather than change my head into another world. So I'm going to do a novella for NaNoWriMo. I'm going to start NaNo a bit later, probably around the 10th of November, so that I have the rest of November to write a novella, which will be in the arcane world. I think it's going to be one day in New York. So looking at New York, and I will be taking Jake Timber to New York. I'm going to have a male protagonist. Shock horror. Jake is one of my main characters in the Arcane series, but he's had a rough time. You know, I'm forever blowing him up and beating him up and doing things. And I've just done something else to him in Gates of Hell, so I figure he needs an outing. So I'm going to do that in NaNoWriMo. Okay, let us... sorry, that's a bit of a long introduction, but hey, big show, you know, big 200, it's important. So let's get into the interview with Alexis Grant. Today I'm here with Alexis Grant. Hi, Lexi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, no, it's great to have you on the show. And just as an introduction, and Lexi has been on before, but for those people who don't know her, Alexis is an entrepreneurial writer and digital strategist, helping you create the life you want to live. And you might know one of her sites, which is The Write Life, which focuses on helping writers create, connect, and earn, which is important to all of us. Now, just as a second introduction, I'm celebrating my 200th podcast episode.
Wow. Yeah, it's that's quite awesome.
I know, it's kind of crazy. And you know, I wanted to have you, Lexi, on the show to talk about things like moving on and what we've learned, because you and I, you're actually one of the it wouldn't have been like the first person I met online, but the first person who I met online that I'm still connected with.
That's awesome. You're very privileged.
Yeah, so and I was thinking, I think it was Twitter. We met on Twitter, right?
Yeah, we did. We did, yeah.
Yeah, when we were both really new on Twitter, we probably had like 10 followers each or something.
It was lucky that we connected then.
Yeah, lucky, or the universe, whatever you want to call it. But let's kind of go back a bit and talk a bit about where we were then and where we are now. So, for example, I didn't even consider writing fiction then, and I've just finished. I've got it here. I'll show you. Just printed out my sixth novel.
Yes. So awesome.
I just finished it today. So, I mean, my life's really changed. My business model's changed. Tell us about your journey from when we met like 5 years ago on Twitter. Where were you then and where are you now?
Sure. I think we met when I was still working at my day job. Yeah. I was working as a reporter. I was covering the job market. And I had my business on the side. So I was doing a little bit of work with other small businesses, helping them with social media. But I ended up leaving that day job to pursue that full time. And yeah, my business has changed a lot since then. For one, I kind of started out as more as a freelancer, and now I am a bit more of kind of a manager. I oversee a small business. I have a team of 10, a lot of writers and editors who help me do the work for our clients. Hmm. So that's changed in terms of the scale of the business and my role in it. I guess that's the major thing. I still do a lot of my own writing and creative stuff like I did when we first met. Hmm. But yeah, I'd say that's the biggest piece.
Because I think we actually both left our day jobs within a month of each other too, right?
Yeah, which was great. So it's been fun to watch you do so well and get to where you are now.
Yeah, and you too. And I mean, this is a very big thing. So let's like start with this stickability and kind of carrying on and not giving up. I mean, both of us use our same, I mean, I had the creative pen. You started with Alexis Grant, which was mm-hmm. the traveling writer at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Right? We've used the same site. We've continued blogging. We've continued social media. We've continued content marketing. Why are we still here when many of the others we started with have not continued?
I mean, I think it is a lot about persistence and being able to push through when it's not easy. I guess I would say entrepreneurship isn't for everybody. So I think a lot of people just realize it's not for them. They maybe don't have the appetite for risk and feeling like it's a little bit riskier than a day job, especially when you're first starting out. I would argue that in some ways, I think it's safer than having all your eggs in one basket. But when you're first starting out, it's really difficult to make that transition in your head sometimes. Mm. So I think there's other things like that that have just kind of pushed other people who may have wanted to do something similar in a different direction. I've seen a few of my friends actually who were self-employed a few years ago and were trying the freelance thing. Decide to go work for an employer because they just, you know, the whole idea of owning your own schedule and setting your own priorities, it's really hard when you're first starting. And I think it takes like, I would say even a year to kind of get to a point where, okay, I know what I'm going to do with my day, I know what I'm doing with my month, I can plan things out and realistically do what I've planned. But it's not easy at the beginning.
No, and I've done like yearly reflection on my, you know, how it's been this year as an author entrepreneur. And year one, I actually had to get an office somewhere else. You know, I go to the London Library because of the commute. It was going to on the commute and getting out the house and leave and having a scheduled leaving time when my husband was leaving as well, and having a coffee in a shop and meeting people. There's all these things that once you're ingrained in a corporate way of living, once you stop doing that, you're just like, what am I meant to do with myself? And you're right, I think it takes a year. And that was my most wobbly time, I think. It was almost the psychology of being out on my own and not, and you know, working alone a lot of the time, like we do as internet entrepreneurs, is like, it was quite scary. So were there any times that you had a wobbly moment?
Oh, of course. I mean, I had a wobbly moment 2 days ago. So it still happens. And I mean, I can give you an example. So the way my business works is we serve a number of clients. We have about 10 clients at any given time. And most of them we keep for months on end because we're basically helping them with blog management. So it's a recurring model. Like, it makes sense for us to work with the same clients again and again and again, month after month. And we just lost a client, and it was actually our lowest revenue client. Who I've known for the last few years that in my head, like from a revenue standpoint, it doesn't really even make sense to have that client, but I just hadn't been able to take the step towards dropping the client because I really liked working with them. And I'd worked with this client for 4 years. So anyways, 2 days ago, this client ended the contract, just in terms of like, I think they've cutting expenses or whatever, you know, it happens. And I had this moment, like, you just feel a little panic, like, oh my God, I've lost a client. And the truth is, the revenue was not, it really wasn't a big deal. It was probably a blessing in disguise in a lot of ways. But even now, you still have that kind of moment of panic. And I think it's partly because of how society is, we've let society train us to feel that panic when really, like, if you look at it logically, like, there's no reason to be, you know, feel anxiety and stress over that. But my point is, I think it is most difficult during the first year, but then you're always going to have self-doubt. You're always going to wonder if you're doing the right thing with your day. You're always going to need someone else to kind of lean on in certain situations. And that's just normal.
Mm. And then what about working hours? I get asked all the time, you know, what is like your work-life balance and stuff? And to be fair, I don't think that you need balance if you're doing what you love. So I had balance when I worked at a day job and then came home and did my writing. Now I do this pretty much all the time. I'm doing something related to writing or, you know, the business or meeting people. And even my trips with my husband, I'm always thinking about how I could use that in my writing. And so I definitely do not have balance, and I love it. So I wonder about you, how do you manage that?
Well, in terms of a daily schedule, I don't work a 9-to-5 schedule. I like to get up and do an hour or two of work and then go to the gym or go out for a bike ride. Like this morning, for example, it's really nice out. We know it's one of the last warm days. So my husband and I went bike riding for 2 hours from like 9 to 11. And I just took a shower and sat down here with you. So I'm getting a late start on my day, but I know that the next, say, 6 hours are going to be really productive. And if I want to work until 8, I can. So I would say I often work a little bit later into the day than most people who work 40 hours a week. And some people mistaken that and think that I'm working a lot. But the truth is because I did other things in the middle of the day. And I really like having that flexibility. Mm. I do think it's hard to turn off. And I would say I struggle with balance in that respect. But I make a conscious effort to do it. Like, you know, this morning I felt like there were things I should be doing for work, but I kind of forced myself to go on the bike ride. And as soon as we were out there, I really enjoyed it. And I think it did me good.
Yeah. And didn't I read, because I got rid of the email on my phone like a year ago. Haven't you done that too?
I have. I did it in the last couple of months. And it was cool to see that you had done that as well. I still have personal email on my phone, but I got rid of my work email. Mm. So I can send an email to a friend or even to one of my team members if I have something on my mind that I want to send to them, but I don't see their response back because I send it within my personal email from my work email. Mm. So I can't see what's in my work email, which has been really good for me actually, because it's forced me to kind of keep email, work email at least, to my laptop. So if I want to check it, I've got to be in front of my laptop. And it just keeps me from always being on my phone, you know, no matter where I am. Or often, like, if I'm, say I'm in line at the post office and I look at my email and I see something that worries me a little bit, then I'm going to think about it until I get home and worry about it. And it's just, it doesn't really help. What would have been better is to just see that email when I got home and then and deal with it directly.
Mm. And I find as well, and this is a bonus for being in England, right? I know that most of my email will be from Americans and it will come in after I've finished for the day. I'm a morning person, so I will definitely get off the computer by 8 p.m. Unless I'm doing like a webinar or something. But I know that between my clocking off and then in my morning, you guys are still asleep. So there's actually not that much point in me checking email or even responding until lunchtime UK time. So what I've been able to do is change my schedule. Well, I'm happier doing it this way anyway, but I write in the mornings and go to the gym like you do. And then I only check my email like at lunchtime. Occasionally I'll do some in the morning, but mostly now I'm getting that real creative doing time without checking email. And I know Tim Ferriss talked about this years ago about batching email, but I do think that that's where we probably have to move to at some point.
Yeah, I agree. I won't say that I've totally mastered it. I've tried it and I kind of go in and out of phases where I do have that kind of creative hour or 2 hours in the morning where I don't check email, but then I always tend to fall back into the habit of looking at it again. So I do think it's a good technique, but it takes some work to kind of force yourself into it.
To get there, yeah. And then just with kind of other discipline and productivity, like I don't like productivity really as a word, but, you know, managing your life, is there anything else you think you do? Like, for example, I'm hardcore with the diary. You know, I diarize for months in advance. Like this podcast is booked, you know, till February, 4 months in advance, you know, mm-hmm. and I always make sure I have time in my schedule for what I need to do. Now I fail miserably regularly and overbook myself, but that schedule is so important to me, and I'm surprised when people don't use a schedule. And I also have Things app as a to-do list. So I wondered about you, what are some of the things that you use that kind of help you regulate your life?
Sure. Well, I guess from a big picture standpoint, coming back to the exercise, that's one thing I would say I do well. I think a lot of the good rules I kind of break, but I definitely exercise every day, and I treat it as though it's like something that's already on my schedule. So whenever someone asks to schedule calls or meetings or whatever during that time, I know every single day when I'm either going to spin, going for a bike ride, or going to yoga, and I absolutely do not schedule anything then. And I don't allow myself to miss that gym time, even if I feel overwhelmed with work, because I just know it's just going to compound the problem. So that's one thing I have managed to do really well, and that works better for me this way than when I was in a day job, because I guess I could get up early and exercise, and I could do it after work, but I'd rather do it as a break in the middle of the day. Mm. So that's one thing. I use my Google Calendar is ridiculous. I forget about it sometimes until someone else sees it and they're like, what the heck is that? Because I have everything on there with all different colors, and I use the task manager. So I typically have like 20 tasks for a day. And then we also use Flow for task management with my team, which is kind of like an Asana or
High Rise. Base camp.
Yeah, one of the base camp. And it's funny because I hear a lot of people talking about those tools and I don't hear as much chatter about Flow, but I think it's awesome. And it basically allows us all to assign tasks to each other. I don't use it as much for my personal tasks, but I know a lot of my team members do. So I can see kind of what's due on any given day for everyone on my team. You log in, and it's almost like a dashboard, like Facebook. You can see what's new and what's been commented on. So that's helped a lot in terms of organization and making sure that things get done when they're supposed to get done. Like, I'm really big on deadlines. Mm-hmm. I believe in being on time and delivering something when you say you're going to deliver it. And I think that's part of the reason why my company has been able to be successful. Mm-hmm. So that helps us do that.
Mm, yeah, I just don't see how disorganized people even manage like to run the stuff. But when you run your own business, you're juggling so many things. Like, I just don't know how it happened. Okay, so I was just like, there's so much we could talk about. I'm trying to think what's most useful for people. Let's just briefly talk about our business models right now, like as in what are our multiple streams of income. So, you know, I have, and we can go through them slowly. So I have a blog where I sell products, and those products are, I still have a few video courses left, but I'm moving away from video courses, which is interesting. Let's talk about them one at a time. So are you doing video courses? Because we both started off doing courses, didn't we?
Yes. I do have courses and ebooks on alexisgrant.com, but I don't have any video courses. And I actually, video is kind of on my someday list. I would love to do it. I think it sounds fun, but I know that my big skill is with writing. And for now that works for me. And I just feel like in terms of prioritizing, I tend to try to do way too many things. And so video is kind of, I've pushed it to the side for now.
Mm. So you still have audio courses and PDF style courses?
I don't have audio. It's all written. So I have ebooks, which are basically PDFs or Kindle version. And I have a couple of courses that they're basically email based courses. So you get an email a day for 4 weeks or however long the course is. Okay. And there's some live interactive components to that as well. Mm. But the main piece of it is email and written.
And an example of that would be
my Twitter course. So it's called Become a Twitter Power User. It teaches you how to make the right types of relationships on Twitter and be proactive about using the network strategically rather than just kind of being on there. So yeah, you sign up, you get one email every single day. And the idea is it's like broken into bite-sized chunks so that there's little tasks you can do every day that will help you grow your network rather than feeling overwhelmed by it, which is how a lot of people feel when they first get on the network.
Mm. Okay, so that's kind of those. And then the other thing from the blog is I don't take advertising, but I have sponsorship and I have affiliate. So sponsorship is like my podcast is sponsored, and then affiliates for things like Scrivener course, Learn Scrivener Fast, and Aweber, I'm an affiliate. So those are two kind of income streams from the blog. Do you do those as well?
I do them a little bit on my own blog, but we do it a lot more on The Right Life. So you mentioned earlier, The Write Life is a website for writers. It's our own brand. It's we launched about 15 months ago. So it's my baby. My team helps to run it. So I don't do all of the day-to-day legwork on the site. I have a team that is helping with it. And I make that clear because I don't want people to think I'm a total superstar in terms of what I'm actually able to accomplish. but we do a lot more affiliate sales and strict advertising on The Write Life. I don't really do it on my site, mostly because I do use affiliate links, and I do make a little bit of money on my site, but it's not a lot because I don't have massive traffic on my AlexisGrant.com. I make a good amount of revenue from my ebooks and courses, but I guess I focused. I have a really, I would say, a very high quality readership, but it's not a massive readership. And a lot of times, to make money on advertising or affiliate sales, you have to have a much bigger following.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, I've had bigger affiliate payments through doing joint webinars. Mm-hmm. Do you use a webinar model?
Yes, I have done that before. I've done joint webinars where I've had someone else come in front of my audience, and then they've sold a relevant, useful product, and I get an affiliate cut, and I've made good money doing that. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of on a one-off basis. And I went for about a year hosting a webinar every single month of my own webinar, where I kind of share information or go over a topic like, how to place guest posts around the web, or I'm trying to think of another example, but you can see my webinars, and they're all free on my website. Anyone who wants, if you can't find them, just let me know, because I don't think they're very prominent right now. But anyways, I did that for about a year because I wanted to experiment with having my own webinars and see whether I could grow my email list that way. Mm. And I did find it to be effective for growing an email list, and even better, for turning people who are sort of passive readers into really loyal fans, because they got to know me better. They saw that I really knew what I was talking about. They appreciated being able to ask me questions and interact one-on-one. But I also found it to be really time consuming. And it takes a lot of preparation to put on a good webinar. And then in addition to that, the promotion aspect. So figuring out, okay, I need a landing page. I need, when do the emails have to go out, and what am I going to do with the emails once? So there was just a lot to do around the webinars rather than just kind of giving them. So, I kind of gave that up a few months ago. I think it was a good experience for me, and I benefited from it, but it's not some place where I want to spend all my time at the moment.
Yeah. Okay. And then, I am a professional speaker, so I get speaking income. I do very, very little consulting these days. I do some one-on-ones, but very little. Do you do speaking or consulting, or is it client work that you mentioned is your big earner?
Client work is a big earner. I do a little bit of, speaking here and there, but I don't seek it out. I'll do it if someone asks me. And I have people do ask me, sometimes do paid speaking gigs, sometimes non-paid. For example, actually after this call, I have a call with a group of students. So, those kinds of things I make myself available for. But speaking is not a big chunk at all of what I earn. And it's certainly not a regular piece of revenue.
Mm. And so basically your client work, as you said, you do content for corporate clients?
They're not really corporate. They're more like small businesses and startups. Mm. So we run a number of blogs, and I can give some examples. A lot of people know that I run the Brazen Life blog, so Brazen Careerists blog, mostly because I kind of started out doing that as a freelancer and transitioned to having my team help more with it. So I'm a little bit of a public face for that particular blog. But for the other blogs that we manage, I'm not a public face, but my team runs all the content behind the site. Mm-hmm. And sometimes these are smaller sites that have, say, like if we were doing it for a startup, they might just have two posts a month, but often they're much bigger sites that would publish, say, 8 pieces of content every single week. Mm-hmm. So it's recruiting the writers, getting all the content in there, optimizing it, publishing it, everything from beginning to end. And that's kind of the direction that I want to go in more. In terms of the client work, is I it's almost like an outsourced newsroom, and my background is in journalism. So I love the especially the clients where we're running like high volume sites. I think that's really fun. So we've had particular luck with people who have already grown a bit of a site, but then they just kind of either don't want to do it anymore or they want to focus on the business side of the site and we do the content. So that's kind of where our sweet spot is at the moment.
Yeah. And then for me, the big change in my business model, obviously, is fiction, which, you know, the percentage of my income from fiction is growing the more books I write, which kind of makes sense, and the more I expand my voice and all that. And so I wanted to ask about your more creative side, because when we, well, that is what you're doing is creative, but I mean, when we met, you were writing a memoir about your year in Africa as a, you know, your solo year in Africa. And you had sent that out to an agent. And then that was probably 4 years ago now. And I wondered, you know, what is happening with that? And what are you planning to do with that other side of your writing?
Sure. So I do feel like even without the travel memoir, I do feel like I still do creative writing. So I guess blogger on the web. I have my own blog where I still write regularly, and I write ebooks for my own site. I'm helping to write an ebook for The Write Life. So there is a lot of writing in there, even though I'm doing a lot of managing as well. But I actually just picked up my travel memoir again, and this was almost 2 years I had put it aside because, like you mentioned, my agent could not sell it. And I just felt frustrated with it, and I was sick of it, to be honest. And I wanted to self-publish at that time, but I couldn't bear the thought of revising it again to get it to the point where it needed to be. And I didn't want to put it out there until it was as ready as it needed to be. So I just put it aside for a while, and I've just picked it back up, mostly because I kind of ran into an editor that has published her own memoir and been very successful, and she was looking to take on a couple of basically book doctoring clients. And so I hired her. And I'm also at a point now where before it seemed like a big leap to pay someone, you know, a couple thousand dollars to help me book doctor my manuscript. Now my client business basically subsidizes some projects like that, with knowing that it will boost my brand and help me bring in revenue in other ways. In general, I'm not expecting the travel memoir to be something that boosts our bottom line significantly or at all. But it's kind of a project that I'm really excited to get out there. So what am I going to do with it? I'm probably going to self-publish it. But I want to do something cool, and I'm not sure exactly what it is yet, because I have a lot of photos and videos that are a real, really fun complement to it. So it might be as simple as just building out a simple website where people can see the accompanying multimedia material. I might use a new digital platform to publish it. I've been thinking through those options, but we'll see. And it depends. It does depend partly on how much time I want to spend on something that I don't think is going to bring me a relatively big amount of revenue.
It's funny though, isn't it? I feel like when I met you, I was, you know, online. That's who I met. I actually met the girl who'd come back from Africa and was writing a memoir, and you were going to these retreats and everything. So I think also for that book, I feel about that book that I want to read it as somebody who, and there will be other people in your audience who heard you talk about this for a couple of years probably, and then stopped talking about it. And I think that it almost completes a journey, because of course now you're married, which is something that's changed over 5 years, as am I, although I was married when we met. But you know, and that is part of your life before all of that. So it's almost like a full circle thing, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, for sure.
Personal project.
Yeah, exactly. And this business journey has changed how I think about the manuscript too, and what I want to do with it. You know, at first I was set on traditional publishing, and, you know, if that option came along, I might still want to do it. But I see the value in self-publishing it, whereas I think at the beginning I didn't. So yeah, a lot has changed in terms of my platform and how I share information with the world, I think.
Yeah. So one of the things, I think one of the themes here is that kind of reinvention aspects of things. And like you've shared, oh, well, I did the webinar thing and I let that go. And you may never have picked up the memoir again. I'm sure there's other things. Like I've the Creative Pen was my third blog. There were two before that. Since then, I've started another one, which I've, you know, left by the wayside. I've switched direction. So this reinvention thing and almost rebranding of yourself, I think some people see it as kind of bravery, and whereas some people would say, oh, you failed with your webinars and I failed with my other blogs. How do you interpret that sense of, or do you ever see failure, or do you have any failures, or do you just see things as reinvention?
I guess in the moment I feel failure about things. And I actually wrote a blog post about how I felt a serious failure when my agent couldn't sell my travel memoir. But besides that, I treat a lot of things like experiments. I know going in that it might not work. And I actually thought you were going to ask me, like, can I share some of those failures? And I was thinking, like, I can't even think of any of them. And I know I have plenty, but I kind of just let it go. Like, it doesn't work and I move on to the next thing. But I do it while having a bit of a safety net. So I have built a client business. And even at the beginning, I had, you know, a section of my revenue that I knew was coming in, and then you can kind of experiment on the side. So it's often a lot of my experiments will happen with The Right Life or thelexisgrant.com. And this is, I think, one of my failures to date is I do have a lot of different projects going on. And I think if I focused on one of them instead of three or four big things, I would be doing much better with that one thing, but I'm not quite ready to give up all these other things yet. So, I guess my point was going to be that, like, when I look at the things that I've done on alexisgrant.com that haven't worked, or on The Right Life that haven't worked or whatever, I know that I'm putting my time and really money, cause I'm not making money in other ways, into those projects, but it's okay with me.
Yeah, and I feel the same way. Like, I don't feel I have failure. I just have kind of experience, you know. I mean, and some of the big, you know, massive things that cost me hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, were before this life. I feel like, well, you know, I had a scuba diving business with a blooming boat, you know, and I had property. I've had a lot of property, which has lost me a lot of money. And, you know, I think the internet life we have, the risk is so small, because our overheads are so small. You know, what do we have here? We have two computers and a you know, webcam, and Skype's free.
Exactly. And it's a lot. It's about your attitude too. I mean, if you talk about things as though you totally failed on something, I mean, then other people are going to think you failed too. If you look at The Right Life, I just did an income report for The Right Life. You could definitely have skewed that as a failure, because I've been putting money into this site for the last 15 months and it's starting to make money now, but it hasn't made a lot yet. And I believe that it will, which is why I continue to invest in it, both mentally and financially. But you could have easily skewed that as a failure. So I think it is about how you look at things. And yeah, you have to know when to let things go, but you also have to know when to kind of stick with something.
Yeah, definitely. And that experimental attitude and that positive attitude, I think entrepreneurs do, you know, they often use the word pivot, which you could, you know, again, it's a reinterpretation. This isn't working. I'm going to pivot.
Right.
So that's the kind of, like you're saying, the positive reframing of what others may perceive as failure.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I would say that that's honest, though. Like I don't feel like those things are failures. I mean, I think you could, like, tell yourself, okay, I've got to frame this as a success so people don't see it as a failure. And I think you can see through that when people do that online. It's really about trusting yourself to know that you can try lots of different things and some of them are going to work and some of them aren't.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the things as well is discovering what you love, because we both gave up corporate jobs because we weren't in love with them. And I find all the time now, I mean, when you start, you have to say yes to everything, right? Because you don't have what's going on. And now I'm sure you do too. You have to say no a lot. You have to say no to opportunities because so many come your way. So I'm at this point of kind of saying, well, what do I love? and how can I do more of that? And then how can I kind of get rid of the stuff I don't love? Is that the type of thing you're going through as well?
Oh yeah, it's a constant reevaluation too. I am terrible at saying no, and I find I'm getting better at it, and I have to push myself to do it more and more and more. Mm. But it's hard when you're an idea person, you come up with a lot of ideas, but you know that. The truth is you just can't do everything. And if I am to pursue one other idea, that means the Right Life is going to suffer, or the client side of my business will suffer. It's just there's only so much you can do, even if you systemize everything and have a great team. Mm. Like it's not even for me. It's not really about hours in the day. It's more about how many components I have in my brain. I just can't juggle so many things, and you can't focus on what needs to be focused on. So I do think that that's – I'm constantly – like I would say every week – rethinking, okay, how do I change this around? How do I reframe this? How do I get rid of something so that I can have more time to do what I really want? And what is it that I really want to do? That's often the hardest question. Mm.
Yeah, and I actually have on my wall here, I have lots of things on my wall, but one of the things says, right to live, what is living today? Because like you say about going for a bike ride with your husband this morning, too often we can go, oh, well, you know, I just no, I can't do that right now. You know, I need to do some work. But actually, we have to remember what is living. And living is sometimes, you know, heading off on a massive walk, or, you know, like going to Africa again, or, you know, doing things that don't necessarily earn us money, but are what the whole point of you and I leaving corporate was about, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Doing this other stuff. That was something else somebody had said to me is, oh, but you could make more money if you outsourced the writing of the books. And I was like, but that's not the point. I was like, but then I wouldn't be able to say, I made this.
Yeah. And you enjoy the writing.
Well, this, and that's the kind of the point. So Do you find that, you know, switch between what you love and what makes the money?
A little bit. I'm trying to think about. I mean,
I guess the memoir is an example.
Yeah. There's definitely things that I do that I know that are not making me money right now, may never make me money. Like some of the things I do aren't making money now, and I'm hoping they'll make money in the future. Mm. But I mean, I think my model may change down the line too. Like right now I am enjoying all the client work, but I do feel a little bit tethered by it. I know that when you have clients, you have to respond to them, and you're not totally free because you still are working for someone else.
Yes.
So I think in the long run, I would love to just be able to focus on my own brands and my own work. But for right now, there's a lot of good pieces to the client side. For one, it is very lucrative, mm-hmm. but also that's where I'm learning a lot. And that's where I get ideas to write about these other things, mm-hmm. To write ebooks. Like, what would I write about if I wasn't actually doing the work? And there are a lot of entrepreneurs who are writing about like how to run an online business who don't actually have an online business other than writing about how to have an online business. And I don't know where they get their ideas from. Like if you're not actually doing the work and you're not really in it, I think that helps me grow and helps me, mm-hmm. it challenges me. So I do think down the line, like that model may shift, or where I decide to put my energy or my team's energy may shift. But for now it's good.
Well, that's what I love about being an indie author, is that freedom. Like, if you know, if you nail everything in your life that you want down to one word, and my word is freedom, that's why I don't do live webinars, because I feel like that's tying in to something in public that I don't necessarily want to do. And why I don't want to be at the beck and call of a publisher or somebody who's could say, no, I want to change the ending or something like that. So I think these core values are so important to our business. But I wanted to ask you, though, you mentioned about, you know, changing things, and what do you see in the next kind of, I mean, even just while you and I have known each other, like the Kindle has gone nuts. You know, we've seen self-publishing go from being a kind of stigmatized thing to being a very positive, you know, business model and exciting and creativity. What do you see in the next 5 years in the online space and also for your business?
Hmm. I haven't really thought much about what I see in the, for the online space. I mean, in general, I think content marketing is getting hotter and hotter and hotter. Because it's, I mean, even all the changes Google has made, they reward real quality, valuable content. So for my business, that's huge for the client side, because that's what we do. And there's just tons of people who want it. So I just think that's going to continue to be hot, in this space. But in terms of self-publishing, I feel like I don't actually follow the self-publishing world, I think, as well as you do. And in some ways, I think I probably should be on top of those trends a little more, because I guess I do follow tech pretty closely, in social media. But on the other hand, sometimes I feel like it's – right now I'm in a phase where I want to get the work done, and I want to create stuff, and I'm out of the phase where I read absolutely every – I do read a lot still, but I don't read everything. I don't look at my Feedly anymore. I kind of read things when they come to me, but I don't spend hours reading stuff. Instead, I'm spending that time actually creating and doing the work. And I think it's easy to kind of get caught up in what's going on out there, right? Like, whereas right now I'm in a phase where I'm kind of turned inward to just do what we're good at and get it done.
And I think too, it's interesting. It doesn't matter, you know, like this document I have here, this story, it doesn't actually matter what changes, because people will still want stories. They'll still want, you know, your ebooks and your story, you know, your story and your information, whatever changes. So whether, you know, the blog stuff changes and we call it something else, or you know, the social media changes or whatever, people still need this. So the tech side changing doesn't really make a difference, does it? You know,
no, I totally agree. And in fact, like a lot of my ebooks, I only offer them in PDF format. And I want to start to offer like a Mobi and an EPUB version, because I am starting to get requests. And I think I first started publishing them when we met, like maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and people weren't reading it on Kindle as much. And I have gotten some requests for the last couple of ebooks that people want to be able to read them in a format that looks better on their Kindle. But generally, sometimes just going with simple and creating something high quality and delivering it in the simplest way is kind of like the biggest bang for your buck in terms of energy.
And I agree with you. Like last year, I think I dropped about 400 RSS feeds, and you know, you almost stop. Is that a confidence thing? Is it when you first start out, you know, when we did, we were learning from all the people, you know, and then you get to a point where you think, I've heard this all before. And now I'm ready, you know, I'm ready to be, I guess, more of a leader in the space. Do you feel that that's been the shift?
I guess. I mean, I don't think of it as that way. I think of it as more as, okay, rather than reading about this stuff, I want to actually do it. And I do feel like a lot of the stuff is regurgitated, and I know it. And but it sometimes it's a good reminder to read it, because I'm like, oh, I'm not doing this, and I should be. So, you know, it is a good reminder, and it gives you ideas. But it's more about, I think, diving in and just executing rather than thinking about executing.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Although one of the thinking about executing kind of memes is a backlash against blogging in this tsunami of content, or content shock, as one author has called it, which we're also having in the book space. I was at a Frankfurt book fair on a panel which was, are there too many books in the world? Totally leading question about this tsunami of content. Now, you're a massive content creator, so am I. What do you feel about people who say there's too much? How do you stand out? You know, what's going on?
Oh, if you have a voice and a personality, people are going to come to you over everyone else. I mean, the ebooks I offer, it's not like you can't get them anywhere else. You could get that information, a lot of it, you could get it for free on the web probably somewhere. But the fact that I put it together with my own experience, and it's a source that people trust, and I've built that trust by providing lots of free content and by interacting with my community over the last few years. If you can if you can provide like really good content and infuse it with your personality, people are only going to want to get it from you. I mean, think about the bloggers that I still follow, even though I've kind of culled down my list. I still, even though I don't go into Feedly anymore, I now subscribe to a few blogs via email, and I read them when they come into my email because I care about the person. I do care about the content, but I care more about the person who's delivering it and how they're delivering it. So I think if you can do that, who cares if there's a tsunami of content out there? I mean, if you can provide something that people want to get from you, then it doesn't matter.
Yeah, and we talked about this before I hit record, but it seems to me that most people are not willing to put in A, the work, and B, the time. Do you think those are just the two things that...
And three, the personality. Like, yeah. People are scared of sharing themselves online for a lot of different reasons. And it is hard to get into a blogging voice where you're authentic and it sounds like you write as you talk. I think it takes some work to get there. So even people who are willing to share have to figure out how to do it in a way that appeals to other people. Mm. But yeah, I think it is, in addition to that, like you said, it's about the persistence and it's about sticking with it over time.
Because realistically, you and I haven't done anything radically different over the last since we met. We've just created good content within the niches we work in. We've met and networked with peers and created relationships, and we've just done that like every day.
Yeah, I think the one thing that I feel like is different is I do think I'm, now that I've been living in the internet world for a few years. Mm. I do know kind of like if I were to launch a website, I know what the top four things would be to do to get it live and to promote it. And rather than trying a million things, because I've done that before, I am able to say, okay, the energy should go in these four places. So I think that's one benefit is you kind of, it's not like there's a shortcut, but you can get rid of all the pieces that, it's the 80-20 rule, right? So spending most of your time on the stuff that's really going to make a difference. And after a while, you kind of figure out what that difference is.
Mm, absolutely. Now, last question before I let you go. I often, you know, we consume things, we produce things, we're creating all the time. What's important is also feeding ourselves and continually kind of learning new things. Who are you learning from right now? What are you learning? What are you excited about that's kind of fueling your creative work?
Well, I definitely, like, one way that I surround myself by other people who are doing what I'm doing is I do Skype regularly with a number of people who kind of live and work in this space, who are also sort of making a living online, because I find that they get it and they want to talk about open rates and subject lines and like little things that, you know, if you saw your neighbor, they're probably not going to want to talk to you about. So that's one thing that has worked for me is I make time to, it's almost like if you're in an office, you would talk to your coworker about what you're working on. And if you don't have that, you have to create that structure for yourself. Hmm. So that's one thing that's worked for me. I also have an office now outside of my home, which I didn't have. I just got it like six months ago. So I didn't have it for the first almost 3 years of full-time self-employment. I worked out of my house and I'm doing that right now actually. So I still do it sometimes, but having an office has been really good for me in terms of getting out of the house and feeling energized and seeing people and talking to people. There's a lot of startups who are based in the office space that I'm in. And so I get to see what they're working on. And so that has helped as well.
That's fantastic. Right. So if people want to know more about you, where should they go?
AlexisGrant.com. I'm always on Twitter at Alexis Grant. And The Right Life, it's therightlife.com. And right is spelled W-R-I-T-E.
I hope my audience know that.
I like, well, you always say pen with a double N, and I feel like that's a really good reminder. So
good point. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much for your time, Lexi. That was great.
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.